This is Raise Your Average, dedicated to making you a better long-term investor. Join us as we sit down with some of the most interesting names in finance to discuss macro, markets, investment strategies, and more.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I'm Pierre Daly.
And I'm Mike Philbrick.
And this is Raise Your Average. Our very special guest, as you can see, is Dave Natig, President and Director of Research at ETF.com.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Wonderful to have you back. Always a great conversation.
Yeah, it's good to be here. There's certainly plenty going on to talk about. Where do you guys want to start?
Oh, well, gosh. What's on your mind? You've been writing a lot. You've been writing a lot about, you know, changes that are coming to market structure. And number one was this mutual fund conversions to ETF series. Potentially like 5,000 in the pipeline.
Well, it depends 5, 000, how crazy this industry gets. I mean, definitely in the U.S., we are at the front end of a flood that is about to start rolling up the shore, because we've now made it very easy for virtually any traditional mutual fund manager to flip a switch, spend $100,000 and get a bunch of their mutual funds wrapped up as ETFs, which sounds fantastic. And honestly, for some of these folks, it's great. There are real challenges, though, because obviously there's thousands and thousands and thousands of mutual funds, and most of those funds would love to get access to the hot new thing that is the 30-year-old ETF wrapper. And there are real challenges in the infrastructure of how the market works, right? Every one of these funds needs to have a lead market maker. Every one of these funds needs somebody sitting there looking for creation, redemption, arbitrage opportunities to keep them trading really tight. And if you're a dimensional funds, right, or one of these large players, then sure, you have the relationships. You can go get an LMM. Somebody will sit there on the desk and mind your fund. If you're some fund company that none of us can remember because the last time we thought about them was in 1994, and now you've decided to get into the ETF industry and nobody on the street has any idea who you are, it almost doesn't matter how great your fund is. There's nobody on the street who's going to want to trade it because they don't know you. They don't understand your strategy. They don't understand how to hedge against it. And worse, a lot of these are very active, or at least were very active strategies that have slowly drifted towards benchmarks. How you actually, you know, do the creation redemption arbitrage against those kinds of products is not necessarily obvious, right? Especially if they're actively managed by somebody who takes a big swing once in a while, that really messes up the process of keeping the ETF infrastructure working. So In general, I'm big on choice, like more things for investors to look at is probably good, but we're really going to start clogging up the pipes here, I would say, in the next 6 to 12 months.
And that's the thing, right? That's the phrase that we keep coming back to. You've been writing a lot about it in the last couple of years, which is that, you know, this sort of taking it for granted that the plumbing works, because it has. I mean, we had some market, you know, what looked like some market seizures, mini crashes in the last number of years, like last April, you know, when we had Liberation Day and a little bit of a seizure in the market, ETFs absorbed the shock, right? There was huge volatility, a record volatility, record volume, and the structure held. The pipes, as you said, didn't burst. And, you know, for a lot of people, that was sort of the end of the story.
Well, right? we've had endless examples of that. I mean, the last time we had a real hiccup in the ETF market was in 2010. That was flash crash, right? That was the last time we did anything to change part of the market structure to make ETFs work better. We've really done nothing since then except clean up some of the rules. And that's great. Like, you're right. The ETF market structure is, I think, at this point, more battle tested than any other financial instrument I can think of. And during the recent war, right, we've seen ETF volumes, you know, get up to over 40% on some days. It's a percent of the trading dollar volume on NYSE. That's huge, right? So that is absolutely where the market writ large globally now understands that they can offload and manage risk very, very quickly. Can you do that when you have twice as many tickers? I don't know. I am skeptical. And I'm really skeptical for the poor, average, normal investor who has to wade through all this garbage, right? That's the other thing, is that part of the reason the ETF has been so successful is people get familiar with them, right? People, SPY and QQQ are household names for people who don't even invest, right? And so that ability to shorthand whole markets, whole asset classes with single tickers is part of why ETFs have been so great for investors. When now all of a sudden you've got not seven or eight S&P 500 tracking ETFs, but 100 and all sorts of different flavors with different weighting schemes and different tax structures and different income distribution strategies, that actually becomes a problem for investors. There's a point at which choice becomes paralytic.
The other thing is, while the pipes haven't burst, there's leaks everywhere. You know, even the largest ETFs, you know, can blow out 10, 15, 25, 30 cents. You can have these things. Even very large, very liquid ETFs, we experience this. Ours aren't super large, but you see it even in the big boys. And if you're trading near the end of the day, near the beginning of the day, around any announcements, around any sort of glitches in technology, you have to be careful. So make sure when you're out there putting in these orders, make sure you're using market orders. Make sure you're not becoming susceptible to
not using, not taking advantage.
You mean limit orders.
Yeah. Yes. Using limit orders and not being taken advantage of by the market makers when either there's an event, there's someone just not looking, or, you know, they are in fact trying to take advantage of a market order for some reason. And so there's leakage everywhere when it comes to this stuff. And it isn't, I don't think it's a doubling, as you pointed out, Dave. It's probably, you know, an order of magnitude of the number of transitions that's going to happen. And you think about that. I want to come back to every one of these needs a lead market maker that is going to go through the process of creating and redeeming that portfolio against the creation or destruction of the ETF that's listed and put in your portfolio. In some cases, the mutual fund structure is superior to the ETF structure. In some cases, for some assets, for some approaches, it's just not all ETFs all the time. Now, on the mutual fund side, Dave, is there an opportunity to see the mutual fund structure used more efficiently where appropriate? And are we seeing any of any sort of on average fee reduction in the mutual fund world? I mean, one of the big critiques is, well, I buy an ETF, it's way cheaper than when I use the mutual fund. Are we seeing any of that narrow? And are you seeing any use cases in the mutual fund world that are either holding ground or building?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes to all of the above. I'm not anti-mutual fund at all. And I've said many times, my actual, like a chunk of my retirement money sat in Schwab index funds for a very, very long time, because it was like 2 or 3 basis points for global market exposure. And what was I going to do better than that? And the convenience and the surety of knowing that I was getting end of day pricing, when we're talking about a basket of thousands of stocks, I'm not caring all that much that I didn't get in at 3 p.m. So I think there are real use cases from a convenience wrapper perspective for the mutual fund, and that will continue to exist. And mutual funds still solve all sorts of problems, largely around fractional shares and retirement accounts where you're and doing any kind of dollar cost averaging. Those things are cleaner and easier in a mutual fund wrapper. And in fact, there are a lot of institutions, believe it or not, that use mutual funds for things like cash management purposes, because they have systems that are already designed for working with money market funds and things like that. So we've actually seen in the US, for instance, we saw FM Investments take one of their ETFs and launch a mutual fund share class on it for exactly that reason, to get access to some markets where the mutual fund was kind of the preferred structure. Now, you know, if we're talking on an academic basis, is the ETF structure more flexible and can you do more with it? Yes, there's lots of reasons why ETFs have been so successful, but I don't think mutual funds are just going to disappear. And Mike, directly to your point, yeah, I think there are places where this gets more efficient and the costs really have come down. Like the median mutual fund expense ratio pretty much in any asset class has come down with the ETF revolution. And so mutual fund investors have absolutely benefited from that crushing cost containment that the industry has gone through. That said, boy, there's some still very expensive funds out there if you don't look carefully.
So is there anything else in this transition that's occurring that we should discuss? There's the unknown unknowns for us. We're not quite as deep in the structuring business.
Yeah, I, I think the only other thing I think that's worth noting is that because there is all of this froth going on with people doing these conversions, there are capacity constraints in all sorts of strange parts of the industry. Like getting legal time in certain corners of the market right now is a little tricky. Everybody's launching something. Everybody's filing something.
Yeah.
And, you know, adding to that, and we'll get to this, the raft of new product ideas that all require some fancy legal footwork has really just tapped out this market, right? There are only so many very high quality investment management lawyers in the country.
Gotcha.
Interesting.
And then is there any asset classes that you're seeing? I mean, we saw the sort of private credit rush. Anything else like that? And I mean, they went the ETF route, I recall. And are they, you know, is this the final dump into the retail buyer on the ETF side? Or
yeah, let's get into that.
It feels a little bit like that. Yeah, I'm not sure about what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah. Look, I think for the most part, at this point in the cycle, when you start seeing everybody who owns private assets trying to offload them into retail, which we've seen several times, you know that we're towards the end of a cycle, in this case, probably the private credit cycle. The products themselves that have launched, like the State Street private credit funds with Apollo, they have been fine. They haven't blown up. There's been no catastrophe. They also haven't really yielded you any spread of note. So I'm not sure why people are all that interested in them. You know, they have not that much private credit in them to start with, and it's pretty short term. So the amount of gain you can get by simply using the unregistered securities or the untraded securities, you know, you're talking basis points here. So I think the demand really hasn't shown up the way people had expected. I think it's also somewhat ironic and perhaps humorous that precisely as the industry was really going with both feet to go into the ETF market and push all this stuff out to retail, the sort of things fell off the private credit market a little bit. So we kind of maybe had a bit of a happy accident or a terrible accident, depending on which side of the marketing table you were on, where the market did not support these things coming out. Now we've got the whole rush of private equity products. These are less easy to wedge into an ETF in our structures. You can get about 15% illiquid into any mutual fund or ETF. And beyond that, you got to start playing some games, which a couple of firms are, and using special purpose vehicles to acquire a lot of SpaceX before they IPO. We've had two very high profile closed-end fund launches here in the U.S. just in the last 2 weeks. There's a U.S. TV, USPE, and another one that are really just designed to grab people's money and never give it back, because that's kind of what closed-end funds do. 5% a quarter, if they feel like it, is pretty low liquidity. So there's a lot of hype around these things. I'm sure that a lot of people will throw their money into them. I think the most interesting thing is going to be when we actually get some of these big high-profile IPOs out and people have to start realizing what happens under the hood, right? How many of the shares inside this vehicle are actually locked up? How many of those are really going to be available to trade on day one? Is the venture fund manager actually going to be unloading at a top tick price, or is he going to hang on to this till the end? And you as the investor, because these are generally low liquidity vehicles, you're not going to get to make that call. You're not going to get to make the call to sell SpaceX on the day it goes into the queues.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is all like, it's not necessarily that it's all like one big, you know, terrible idea, but it invites a whole host of problems, right? Because of liquidity mismatches, timing, misconceptions or misperceptions about, you know, what the liquidity is. It seems like a lot of problems in semi-liquid private assets is that the investor didn't understand going in that it was actually illiquid.
Yeah. I think that's a big part of it. And they don't understand the information mismatch, right? I think that's the other big part of this is, with XOBR, one of the big ETFs that owns a bunch of SpaceX, there have been real questions about how it values the position that's in there, because it held it at a flat price for a year and a half. And then gapped it up. And so the question is, well, where did but none of that showed up in the NAV. And nobody I've talked to can figure out how did it gap up if the NAV didn't change? And yet that seems to be what happened. So there's a lot of, I'll just use the word shenanigans. There's shenanigans that goes on, and how you account for, how you trade, how they sell, and how investors actually access private securities. To your point, Pierre, I think people very often don't understand the liquidity on these things. They hear something like quarterly liquidity, and they don't realize that 5% is 5% of the fund. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get 5% of their money out. They're going to get in line with everybody else to get their 5% out a quarter. So I think people really need to go into this thinking, if I panic and start taking my money out tomorrow, it's a minimum of 5 years to get your money back out. And I think that's longer than the duration of most people's houses. Right? Like, that's an incredibly long time. You can flip your house before you can get your money out of this.
Yeah. I think that was part of the damage control that private credit and private equity had to do this early. I mean, a few months ago after following the meltdown in SaaS stocks. And, those two were related. The private credit gating, private equity gating that was happening, or the private funds gating and causing all this stir. I mean, the damage control was huge, right? I mean, the perception was blown out of proportion and, or the misperception was blown out of proportion. And then there was a lot of explaining to do, right? Which is,
right? Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out that we haven't actually had a giant private credit blow up yet, right? Like, we haven't actually had a Third Avenue moment. We had Blue Owl do what I would consider some fairly routine liquidity management of a fund that on the way to wind down, but it's not like, nobody had to show up with the FBI and haul anybody out of a building, right? It was relatively orderly. I think it's very reasonable to be concerned that we may have a blow up around that. And to your point, so much of the private credit boom has been around data centers, software as a service companies, all of those sort of big infrastructure build outs, which we know from the Foxconn deal in Midwest, these companies can just walk away from, and the bag holders are often the locations themselves or the folks holding the private credit, and the companies generally get to walk away scot-free. So how much of this private credit boom is excess of, excess inventory, if you will, excess spending on facilities that may or may not actually be needed? I think it's really tough to call. I think it's reasonable to think some of it is a bubble and that it's going to unwind, and there are going to be some of these funds that have real difficulties with liquidity.
Yeah.
Same old.
Yeah.
So, Dave, it's both exciting and concerning at the same time that, first of all, we now have more ETF tickers than stocks. I know that's
letters, versus words, that one doesn't bother me so much, but yes, we are absolutely in the flood the zone era of the market.
Yeah. So there's this proliferation that's happening organically, like within the industry itself, where new products are coming to market. The same vehicle that was used to build the Vanguard empire and so many others now is being used to package leverage single stocks, prediction markets, we've already talked about the private equity side, where you've called that taking the bags off, but in the sort of innovation space of these ETFs that are really sort of catering to more speculative, tilting investors, that adds to the proliferation of ETFs in the market. And then when you couple that with this ETF conversion from the mutual funds, and then you have this vast change, in the number of tickers, like, we're going to have a multiple of tickers, a multiple of ETFs available versus the stocks themselves.
Yeah.
Or versus, absolutely, the underlying assets themselves. Doesn't that, like, what does that ultimately do? Like, we talked about market makers, where's a bottleneck there.
Yeah, to me, the real issue isn't so much a bottleneck, literally, where everything's trying to run through the single pipe. Although I think with the single stock stuff, there is a bit of there's a bit of reality to that, right? I mean, if we have Tesla, the single security that everybody understands, and on the other hand, we have multiple firms doing multiple levered versions on that, inverse versions on that, and income versions on that, right? It's completely reasonable to expect within another year or two, we'll have 50 single stock ETFs tracking just Tesla. So, you know, average that out across the S&P 500, you're going to end up with maybe 2,500, 3,000 ETFs just targeting S&P 500 stocks, molding their patterns of returns. The challenge here is, of course, there's real issues about all of those folks trying to access Tesla beta effectively in order to achieve all of those different outcomes. Most of the time, I don't worry about that. It does create the opportunities for all sorts of interesting cascading and self-referential trading problems, right? If one swap counterparty is trying to get their exposure from another swap counterparty, you can imagine worlds in which you end up with sort of paper and notional exposures that aren't actually backed by underlyings. So I don't want to be a scaremonger about that, but you've set all the things on the table to have those kinds of sort of magical trading problems where people are trading against each other's and there's no underlyings, or one thing breaks and that's the thing that, you know, hits a cascade of collateral that nobody expects. Those kinds of problems, I think, are real and are possible. But I don't want to be super negative on the innovation, right? I would say the ETF industry has gone through its own version of the K shape on innovation, where on the top of the K, we've got, I would say, genuinely interesting institutional quality products that solve problems most retail investors may not have believed they had. I'd actually, Mike, I put some of your stuff in that category, like the return stacking stuff, institutional quality portfolio, portfolio management tools, risk management tools that institutions have used forever. So like, great, awesome. Auto callables, not for everybody, but like sticking structured products that don't suck, a cheaper prices into an ETF wrapper and giving people daily liquidity. I'm okay with that. Like that's legitimate innovation in the space. Simply slapping leverage on every other ticker in the market, I don't consider innovation, right? That is just sort of abusing the system to extract more from retail. In the middle, we have sort of new product ideas that are easy to get angry about. Prediction markets being the biggest one for me, which, like, I don't have some moral problem with prediction markets. I do have a problem with the fact that we have a single venue in the United States to settle every prediction market ETF that's coming to market on, which is Kalshi, who is both the only place to exchange money back and forth, the only source of beta for the ETFs to unload onto, and the only adjudicator of the final contracts themselves, which is a lot of single counterparty risk, in my opinion, right? So like, that's my issue with the prediction market stuff is we don't really have a market. We have a single firm, and that makes me nervous. So like, there's a spectrum here. There's the truly ridiculous and horrific stuff, which is just extractive. There's the real genuine innovation, which is mostly happening at sort of this more institutional level where prices are getting compressed and outcomes are getting, are getting better. That's awesome. And then it's in this middle where it could go
Well, with the prediction markets, for example, like the prediction markets themselves aren't regulated and they're not SEC regulated, but the ETF is.
In the US, the CFTC has been given the authority on prediction market contracts. The only venue that I'm aware of, and I don't want to claim to be the super expert on this, but the only venue I know of in the US that is actually regulated by the CFTC to do this is Kalshi, right? So it's not like we have seven different exchanges or 50 different firms competing here. We effectively have a single venue, if you'll call it that, in Kalshi. And it is technically regulated by the CFTC, although I have to point out, we don't actually have a CFTC right now. We have a single individual. There's no commission. There's a dude, a seller. And they fired pretty much everybody who did all the work that the commission used to do. And they're sort of these stub groups left of, enforcement and legal and all that. But like, that makes me nervous in its own right, which is we handed this brand new, shiny, innovative market idea to basically a defunct regulator who's only regulating a single entity, which is the only entity between the whole ETF complex. I don't know. Mm. Seems a little sketch to me.
I guess that's where they start.
Yeah.
Now, how do you see AI playing a role in all of this as we move forward?
Oh, that's a big one. I'm very skeptical of AI in investment management, like AI picking stocks. I've spent a bunch of time with the folks at Pictet who are not using sort of generative LLM kind of AI. They've been doing old school machine learning stuff for a while. And Wright, who's running that, comes out of a long 20-year history of BlackRock building those kinds of systems. And I think there's real opportunity there. And the window that Pictet seems to be opening up, and a lot of their competitors in the academic journals, suggest that there's now kind of like a week to 3 week window where you can actually do some machine learning to really get some edge on pricing and trading. That's very different than I'm picking stocks for the long term, which there's no evidence that an AI helps you do that at all. In fact, there's no evidence that being a human being helps you do that at all. Right. For the most, that's why indexing works. Right. So I'm unworried about AI hitting there. I think, like everybody else, you know, who reads for, you know, living, I'm concerned about AI's impact in lots of other places in the economy and labor markets in particular. Yeah. I don't particularly have a hot take on any of that. I'm just a frog in the boiling water with everybody else on that stuff. But I do think that our industry is particularly vulnerable to that kind of job displacement and knowledge loss and training gap stuff that we know AI is going to bring, because we're in the knowledge work business, right? A lot of what we do is move information around, or we have interpersonal relationships and, you know, salespeople and wholesalers and stuff like that. That never goes away. But boy, a lot of that other stuff does. I see it in my own work. I get so much more done now, but I also am not hiring a person or two I would normally have hired.
And how do you think tokenization is going to play with respect to, you know, you're seeing those money market funds at the institutional level, getting the billions and billions of dollars billed and whatnot. When does this matriculate down to the actual ETF, the TradFi world, and we start to see those tokenized for the individual investor? Or what are your thoughts just generally?
Yeah,
let's start bigger.
Yeah, I'm very pro tokenization. I think I will die in a tokenized world. It's just a question of how we get there or kind of how soon I die. The interesting and somewhat the oxymoron or the sort of surprise of tokenization is that I suspect we're going to see much more of it happen at the institutional level than we will at the retail level for a long time. For tokenization to matter to the mom and pop investor, it's got to be endemic. It just has to be the water we're swimming in, because then they'll go to their app and they'll get all this instantaneous settlement on whatever financial products they're using. And it will just remove a level of friction from them. But let's be really honest, that friction's really low already, right? Like opening up your Chase app and buying a stock, or opening your Schwab app and selling a mutual fund. There's very low friction in this already. Very few people really care about settlement and whether or not, you know, the fact that the money in their account is from the settlement or being advanced to me by Schwab when I sell something. Nobody really cares, except for institutions, where if you're going to age my collateral for 24 hours, you better pay up, Mudda, right? Like, I mean, in the institutional market, minutes matter, right? You know, $1 billion by the minute is like legitimate interest. And so we see that happening. We see like BlackRock leaning very hard on some of these institutional collateral platform problems. The real issue is going to be, what's the legal structure that's in place for this to trickle down outside of these closed systems into the public market system? The DTCC has a great project going on this. I'm a big fan of the way they're approaching it. They're sort of creating a sidecar system initially, you know, to do like, you know, corporate and large index stuff, with the intent of eventually you're taking the whole corporate listings process on chain, right? You're creating an actual digital record, that actually has atomic settlement in it, that doesn't everything have to roll up to a single ledger as seed and company. Like it would redefine what corporate equity markets look like in the US, and thus the whole equity market, the whole trading infrastructure. I think that's 10 years out. I don't think this is something you're going to do quickly. I really don't think you can do it without a law at some point being passed. I don't think you can just regulate a new market system into being. I think there's going to have to be some legal work that gets done. to me, that means it's going to take a long time because we don't actually pass laws in this country anymore, right? We just argue about them. So it's going to take some time for that to happen. But I'm very confident the work is getting done and it's getting done well. The biggest hurdle, I think, that people who are noodling about tokenization don't really think too much about is whether they actually want it. Right. I think the challenge of tokenization is if I sell you, I want to be able to sell my Tesla right now at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Do you really want that unrecoverably settled at 201? Or are you comfortable having an overnight process where somebody takes a look at it and makes sure there was somebody on the other side of the trade and I really meant to sell it, or I didn't want to extend my margin that much, et cetera? All these things happen in our slightly slow settlement process that are really very pro-investor, right? I mean, fat finger trades, right? How many guys on Wall Street have managed to take advantage of the fact that you can get a clearly erroneous trade unwound? You can't do that in a blockchain. You really can't. You have to go through a lot of work. You have to do rollbacks or forks. Like, you're not doing this because grandma fat fingered or oil trade, right? So the atomic settlement comes with, in my opinion, way more problems than it solves for the normal investor.
The normal investor, true, but it's that institutional case. It's the commercial case, right? Where you're settling across jurisdictions for big dollars and the centralization.
Known counterparty.
Yes. And
like XRP, like
traceable. Yeah. The traceable custodial ownership, right? You got that custodial certainty on chain. And it happens very quickly. It happens outside of banking hours, and it's a global world. Now, does that have to happen for the individual? Less so. It'll be like, Amazon, the internet and Amazon. Everyone uses the internet to purchase the stuff that comes to their door every day. But it's now just everywhere. It's on their phone. It's ubiquitous.
Right.
So it's accepted.
Right. Exactly.
And that's how it'll embed itself into the world. And to your point, you want to go buy Bitcoin with your own keys, pay the spread, pull it back into a wallet of your own. IBIT is cheaper. IBIT has got tighter spreads. And then if you're going to custody that Bitcoin with somebody who's going to look after it because you don't want to custody your own keys, you want to have some security, those rates are sort of 35 to 50 basis points. IBIT's 36 basis points. It's in your brokerage account and the spread's tighter. Again, TradFi, a win for TradFi, once it gets its act together and decides it's going to do something, it does it quite effectively.
I think one interesting angle on that, I agree with everything you just said, and I think an interesting angle that I've been reading from the crypto crowd in particular is that the TradFi entry into crypto was so violent and so successful, right? I mean, to your point, IBIT is now the easiest and cheapest way to own Bitcoin, right? On the old crusty rails we were supposed to be getting rid of.
Yeah.
That combined with the rise of prediction market trading has had, people are positing, has this weird effect on the whole altcoin market, where all the people who might have been doing all this trading activity on chain and Bitcoin and ETH and then had gotten into trading in altcoins, all of that money has now gone in one of two directions. Either went TradFi and it's just sitting in the crypto, or that money is no longer trading all the altcoins and playing around on Hyperliquid. It's actually just straight up in the betting markets. And I think that, hard, right. Impossible to prove. But I think a relevant discussion, right? Are we simply moving the ball from one court to another with the sort of rise in effectively financial prediction markets?
Yeah. Hyperliquid is a really interesting case, though, for the if people don't know, this is a market that is a smart contract market and oil. You want to see what oil's trading like on the weekend? You want to see what the S&P is trading like on the weekend? It's all there on Hyperliquid for you to go observe if you'd like to with some pretty good volume. So,
we're
going to move towards 24-hour markets.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question, Mike. I mean, you're a little bit more internationally savvy on this stuff than I am. Do you think that something like Hyperliquid and a competitor or two effectively become the global token market? Like, that's where all of the money moves around in that crypto space? Because it certainly reads that way, right?
Yeah, I think there'll be competition. I think there's a lot of revenue, and where there's a lot of profit, there's going to be competition in order to divvy up the profits, for sure. I do think, you know, the regulators have said, the head of the SEC said, we're moving towards that, you know, at least 23 and a half hour, if not 24 hour trading. So we're being told by the regulators that's coming. And as you mentioned, the DTCC project that's going on, I mean, that's big. That's where everybody sort of says, here's how we settle up at the end of the day. And those become very big dollars. And that's where, you know, pennies matter. And it is moving forward, though. This is the thing. Like, you see progress. There'll absolutely be hiccups to overcome and edges to smooth out. But I, like you, believe that we will be in a tokenized world.
But we are, I think, approaching Zeno's paradox in terms of how much more disintermediation we can enact, how much inefficiency we can actually destroy. When I started in this industry, Mike, when we were kicking around in the 90s, right, we were talking about percents, right? We were getting rid of percents of inefficiency, right? Now we're talking about getting rid of basis points of inefficiency. And when we're talking about stuff like the difference between tokenized settlement and non-tokenized settlement, we're talking about fractions. We're talking about mills. We're talking about tiny amounts of money that literally don't roll up to a coffee cup in a millionaire's account. And those kinds of efficiencies, you're right, people are going to chase them because you throw enough bees on something and there's still a lot of revenue underneath the hood. But it's the kind of thing that for the average investor is going to be completely irrelevant.
But does that also mean that we would have access to overnight markets in equities?
We already do. Yeah. I mean, Hyperliquid trades them all 24/7, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Yeah. They're real interesting issues around what that does for things like, contractual pricing, right? Because not every contract is also going to become atomically settled. So, you know, you're going to have to strike NAVs, right? We still strike two fixes in London on gold. Like, I mean, there's still going to have to be points in time where we have to say as a society, this is worth a dollar, right? Because otherwise, if it's always in motion, you can't really do business. So 24/7 trading comes with that weird thing of, well, somebody still now has to play timekeeper and decide what times matter where.
Yep. Yeah, I agree entirely. And that's going to be fun to figure out.
Yeah.
Fascinating. It's fascinating. I mean, even just very simply, if you look at, you know, the S&P 500, since it's such a, you know, dominant holding in people's portfolios, like being able to take advantage of, you know, post North American trading hours, there's so much that happens before the opening bell and after the closing bell that we don't traditionally have access to, right? So when that becomes something that's readily available, other than through the options market or through futures, which is kind of off to the side for retail investors in general, but not institutionally, like, the amount of opportunity, you know, grows exponentially. It's a huge distinction. Like, when you see what happens in overnight markets or post trading markets, there's so much activity that we don't, you know, we get to see it in the news. We get to see what's happening in the futures, but we don't have access to it traditionally.
Yeah. I'm not going to suggest that that's a bad thing. Like, not having access in this space means you're not getting ruined in illiquid markets. Now, look, I can easily imagine a world where we have 24/7 trading in Tesla and the volume is a flat line all day long, but that is not the world we're anywhere near right now, right? We know that right now there's a volume smile that starts in the morning and ends in the afternoon in New York, right? And if you really want to move large blocks of any equity, you're going to trade it, you know, sometime after breakfast and before lunch,
right?
you're gonna wedge that in at like 11 o'clock. That's where you're gonna shove as much volume as you can through, depending on which security you're in. That's never, I really don't think that's ever gonna change. I still think there are going to be hubs where the volume for specific securities lives. Right. And now, and we look at all these global companies that are US listed and we say, well, that volume seems to be concentrated on, you know, East Coast US time zones. I don't think that it's really going to break way out of that. I don't think we're going to live in a world where we're going to see a Tokyo spike in Tesla volume that's similar in size and liquidity that we get in New York, right? I just don't see it. Now, there are definitely cases where that is not true. Gold, precious metals being the biggest one, right? The China gold market for spot is now, I think, bigger than the New York gold market for spot. Like, Asia has gone nuts on their gold volumes. Yeah. So you can absolutely get those kinds of things moving around. But at the end of the day, you're still going to have a market for a security that's registered. Gold has the beautiful effect of not being registered anywhere, right? Take a 400 ounce London Good bar, take it anywhere in the world, buy a yacht.
Yeah, exactly. And for
that's great. I mean, the arbitrage opportunities.
Yes.
It's no longer the arbitrage. Like, you know, you said, like, if you go back to the 90s, 80s, 90s, the arbitrage that once existed doesn't exist any longer because everything's traded into decimals. And I, you know, to your point earlier, I remember when still things were traded 16ths, eighths and quarters, and the spreads were just huge.
You know,
like if you were a trader of any kind, the spreads you could exploit were massive.
Yeah.
Now we're talking about pennies.
Yeah. There's only so much left to squeeze out of the system, you know?
Yeah. And there are professionals out there that are arbing ADRs across markets and things like that. They do make money.
But again, they're rarely picking up percents anymore. They're picking up basis
points. Oh, agreed. Yeah, agreed. It is smaller and maybe that with the tokenization gets, I don't know, reduced even further. Again, what's the impact?
It should, right? Individual advisor.
Yeah. Yeah. But what's the impact for the individual advisor, the individual investor who's got a long-term time frame? I mean, the liquidity's there. You know, nothing. If you want to sell it after 4 o'clock, you can. If you wake up at 6 a.m, okay, you can sell there, which you can kind of do now. But you know, if you're investing for longer term time horizons, none of this is really all that impactful. And I think that's probably where Dave leans a little bit on the covered writing and the volatility and the double stacked or the double levered types of investments where that's not really long-term investing. That is speculation.
Right. Yeah.
And at that point, you might as well trade it at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. And so, you know, does that
we'll leave that to the youngs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it's stuff to do at times, I guess. And the market does like capital sloshing around to be arbed or arb, I guess. But they're costly in the underlyings. I think that's the other thing. When you're looking at a double levered ETF, not only do you have that higher volatility that wears away at the capital, but they're expensive. Like, it's not just the MER, it's the cost of creating the leverage and the exposure, which the investor endures over time, which are high and not really getting cheaper.
Like, the industry really loves their big, expensive income and leverage products. And there's some competitors coming to market that are claiming that they want to go after that with an efficiency hammer. So everybody will get vanguarded eventually. But even then, like, all that stuff's always going to have a premium associated with it.
Yep.
Well, yeah, with the proliferation, you know, with the proliferation of all, you know, from our earlier conversation, Dave, do you see that proliferation making the market more efficient? Or is there more room for, like, ultimately, is it more efficient or does it lead to dislocations?
Well, I mean, I think there's a tipping point that is unknowable, right? So, when there was only one ETF tracking the S&P 500, the entry of the second ETF tracking the ETF on 100, the S&P 500 was brilliant, right? Because now all of a sudden it was real price competition, right? So the price of SPY has come down by a factor of 3, I think, since it launched, right? So yeah, we can make things more efficient by having more players come in, skinning the cat differently, et cetera. Until we reach to the point where the incremental new fund or incremental new player is taxing the ecosystem. right? When the new fund becomes a burden on trading, it becomes a burden on the data provider and the broker and your ability to find it on Schwab's page, right? There becomes a point where it is no longer adding efficiency. It's actually adding inefficiency to the system. And I feel like we're probably right around that line. Like, I mean, most of the funds that I'm seeing now are not really improving market structure by their presence. There are edge cases and innovations, right? Like auto callables is an interesting case in point. The presence of auto callable ETFs has driven down the price of structured products. Most structured products are garbage, but hey, if that's the market you're in, it just got more efficient. That's a net positive. I'm willing to celebrate that. So yeah, it's great when these things come in and have that effect of driving prices down and increasing access. But I think the opportunity set's getting thinner, and now more and more of what we're seeing is kind of just clogging up.
So I think we have to default to, you know, all these new product innovations and launches, whether they're speculative or accumulative long-term or speculative short-term instruments, they're all really, you know, they should be viewed as tools.
Yeah.
By serious investors. I mean, you know, I
always think of this as, I use the metaphor of the kitchen drawer, right? You've got one kitchen drawer that has the stuff you use almost all the time. It's got the big spoon and the good chef's knife and the tongs, right? And like that's your S&P and your international exposure and your treasury funds and your high yield bonds. And like, those are your core there, right there. And then you got the drawer off to the left that's got all that stuff in that hurts your fingers when you go in and try to grab that one cheese grater that your cousin gave you for Christmas last year. That drawer can be a real problem, but they're also those things that are really useful that you know, I really do need a garlic grater. I grate a lot of garlic. So if those tools, to use your metaphor, those tools can actually be really effective, but you can also really end up in a situation where all of a sudden your kitchen's just full of junk that you really don't need and never use. And if you just went back to using the tongs and big spoon and chef's knife, you'd probably be better off.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you just need analogy. Sometimes you go out and you buy a hole punch, you know, like a for one use, and then it goes up on the wall on the tool rack, right? Yeah. You know, I think I might need that.
There's a proliferation of products, and there isn't a lot of assembly instructions. Right. So exactly. Like I need to make a souffle, or I need to make a meal that requires some special tools in the kitchen. Well, that's great. You got a recipe and you know what the tools are for and you know explicitly what they do, and they make the job of preparing the dinner a little easier. Right. What we see is a lot of tools in the junk box, right? You've got that. Everyone's got the junk drawer. And so generally you see a lot of these things that are used ad hoc as though they're in the junk drawer rather than thoughtfully positioned in the portfolio, being used for what they're there for. You know, even a levered ETF, if you're going to trade that daily and you're going to delta hedge it, or you want to have a short position because you're hedging some long position, these are all very viable ways to use these things. And you would look at those fees just like you would look at the exposure that you were achieving in your S&P, and you'd say, well, I want the one that's cheapest. I want the one that has got good execution. And it's not always about the MER, right? There is a spread. There's how much it trades. How much are you trading versus, you know, if it's 4 basis points versus 3 basis points, but you're paying an extra 5 basis points every time you transact, on the less expensive one, then you probably want the one that's 1 basis point more expensive. But again, we're getting into, you know, institutional mindset and decision making, not that individual investors don't have those tools and abilities. Many of them do. There's lots of very sophisticated retail investors who do understand all of that. Right. I guess our fear is that there's a lot of people that are just using them, you know, for a little bit more speculative purposes and don't actually understand what's going on under the surface, because it's not easy to understand. And sometimes not all the facts are easy to ascertain. And so you have to be really careful, keep it more simple, if you will, stick with more simple recipes in the kitchen, and, you know, make sure you're paying attention to the assembly instructions, because having a bunch of tools and not knowing how to use them is dangerous.
Yeah, I love the framing of the recipe, the instructions, right? Mm-hmm. And I think about the huge boom we've seen in things like model portfolios, which I think is part of what mm-hmm. they do is try to solve that problem by being sort of sample instructions. Like, here's what other people do when they're trying to make a souffle that looks like this. And I think those are fine to a point, but I think when we get into what I would call slightly more extractive products, like ones that probably don't need an instruction manual, they need a round file to dump into. Like I'm thinking about some of the levered yield stuff, right? Where you're promising people 50% monthly distribution yields for capital and stuff. Like, I mean, those things, like their version, the thing that's frustrating is they're versions of them that are fine and make good sense, right? Taking like equity income is not a terrible idea by itself. JP Morgan's equity income product, like being used by millions of people to great effect, but they're not trying to engineer a headline number to take advantage of a retail investor. So the instruction, you're right. There's a lot of very sophisticated product out there that when used well is solving real problems very efficiently in ways we've never had before. There's also this other group of folks out there that is just extracting. And the challenge is how do you separate the two? Because on the surface, you can't checkbox it. It's like, oh, uses derivatives, has some leverage in it. Like, check. Like, none of those are the reason it's bad, right? Those are just its tools, and you can use them for good or you can use them for evil.
Yeah, you hit on a great point. Like, let's talk about some of the covered call writing ETFs that have this huge headline yield, whether they're going to play it weekly or monthly or daily, all of it's kind of a bit nonsensical in that sense. But if you're an investor and it says it's yielding you 25%, and you look at the total return over the last year, and the total return is 5%, and it yielded you 25, it didn't yield you 25. You got 20% of your capital back, and you got a 5% return. Actually, just take a look, take a pause and have a look. What was the total return received versus what was the yield or income that they promised? And a good litmus test on that is simply that. What was my total return over the last year? And if it was significantly less than that, you might be falling prey to some marketing that, is not designed to really help you.
Shenanigans.
Shenanigans.
Now we're not here
bordering on skullduggery.
We're not here to slag the ETF business.
No, not at all.
These are where you have to dig in, and we're actually having Convexitas come on in a week or two because they're very thoughtful in the way they think about delivering a covered call portfolio or actually a yield from the volatility that occurs in securities, right? Because when you have a covered right as an example, and you're doing sort of these simple model monthly type things, well, they're going to put a bunch of positions on at a point in the month, and then prices are going to change, and the actual exposure that you have is different from day one to day 15 to day 30, right? If you've had a run in the price and all of your stocks are trading well within their covered right, they're in the money a bunch, you don't have any upside. You've got maybe some reduced downside, but you have significantly reduced upside. I don't think investors kind of understand some of the nuances of the portfolio construction side the covered writing side of it is a kind of an interesting space where you can highlight that a bit more. Now, if you're going to hold it for a long period of time, maybe all that washes out. But if you're in and out of it, it just changes that the character of the investment on a very short time frame. And you need to be aware of those nuances as you're using these tools to bake your portfolio cake, if you will.
Yeah, and
that's just one example.
We're definitely not slagging on the ETF industry, Pierre. I totally agree with you. It just highlights the fact that you can get everything into an ETF wrapper at this point, and not everything is good for you, right? So just because you can buy it in the grocery store doesn't mean you should eat it. And it doesn't mean that those foods should not exist. torturing all the metaphors today. But I think you just, as you get to a more sophisticated looking product, you actually need to ask more common sense questions, right? That's the secret.
Absolutely.
You need a PhD to understand the product. You just need to be able to ask the simple questions about why you're buying it and what it's going to do for you.
So, I love what you're doing, Dave. Like, I think, you know, you have this lifelong experience around the ETF space. And, you know, it's what I think is amazing is that you're actually, you're in the center of it and you're raising these questions because, so few folks in the industry are raising these questions. Right. And having these dialogues.
I think generally not profitable.
Well, exactly. It's not, you're not,
but it's helpful.
You're not.
Well, but, do what but, I can.
But you have to poke holes in the industry, right? You have to poke holes in the activity to get people like to be thought to provoke the thought that's required. Like people need to, have counterpoints to what's going on in the business. But what you're actually speaking to is things people are actually thinking about, but don't know how to vocalize it or don't know how to process it. You know, people look and say, oh, what the hell is going on here? Well, who's going to buy a triple levered, you know, a triple levered or whatever Tesla? And I'm never going to talk to my clients about that, but who's bringing this to market? Why are they doing that? Right. And then it kind of gets pushed off to the side of the desk or off the desk completely. Like that's off, you know, that's out of my purview. I'm not even going to touch that. But you still left with this lingering question of why.
Right.
Right.
And we should point out that like the ETF has been this incredible gift to investors and it keeps on giving. And I could easily spend just another whole hour here talking about funds that I think are incredibly cool that have launched in the last year. So it's not like there's so much fantastic innovation going on that the real issue is not that somehow the ETF structure has become corrupt or anything like that. It's just that we got to pay attention to the bad apples because we don't want to create a world where all of a sudden everybody's painting ETF with some broad brush of malfeasance when in fact it has just been this incredible gift.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely.
You know, like that's part of the challenge, right? When it becomes ubiquitous, right? It almost has this level of trust that says, oh no, you're always okay in an ETF. And this is part of the challenge, right? Structure does to some degree dictate strategy. You know, you were talking about your Schwab 2 to 3 basis points mutual fund that was global, probably had some emerging markets in it. Those emerging markets trade in different time zones and different currencies. Yeah. And those markets aren't always as liquid as you might think they are in the US hours. Even our products, we have products that are mutual funds. We have products that are ETFs. In the ETF products, you have to have a market maker that can create and redeem and hedge themselves. And if that hedging ability is compromised because a market has less liquidity, because it's trading, you know, at a different time in US markets, it just isn't as effective in an ETF portfolio as it would be in a mutual fund where you're only striking a NAV at 4 o'clock at the end of the day, once things have settled down. And so you do have to think through those parameters as you design products. We have experienced that. You know, mutual funds can trade 65 different futures in all kinds of different time zones. ETFs, 25 to 30, because, you know, a lot of those future contracts don't necessarily have the liquidity required for the market maker to make really efficient markets during the day. Mm. And so that's just another one of those, you know, things that you have to consider. The ETF is an absolutely spectacular innovation. It has, you know, tax advantages that have been talked about, you know, ad nauseum. It's brought fees down to points where it's incredibly cheap to own certain betas. Those are all great things. And that is the vast, vast majority of assets are in that space and they can do wonderful things for investors. In these newer spaces, different spaces, you do have to be a little bit more cautious and informed. And Dave, as Pierre said, you do an absolutely fantastic job and an incredible service to both investors and advisors and institutional, I mean, investors writ large, whether they be institutional, retail, you do a great service in helping them sort through that complex and a complicated area of investing, for sure. And so thank you for that. Keep doing the good work.
Well, thank you.
You say no, so nobody pays for it.
So Dave, I wanted to ask you, because you know you were previously at ETF.com, then you broke out on your own, DaveNatting.com. You were working with the fellas at Excess Returns.
Yep.
Excess Returns, right? Yeah, at Excess Returns.
Yep.
Yeah, which is wonderful. And then now you're back, and now you're president and director of ETF research at ETF.com. So what precipitated that?
Yeah,
I'm just curious.
It's a long, sordid tale of structural. You know,
it's a good story. I was happy to see it.
It's my third time at ETF.com. Chief Investment Officer, which was a weird title. I've been Director of Research twice now. I was CEO for a couple of years, and now I'm back as President. And Matt Middleton, who also most people know from the Future Proof businesses, is our CEO and is really running the business. And my job is basically what I'm doing here, right? My job is to be sort of the ETF gray hair in the room, to write, to produce content, and to get people talking about what's actually important to folks. The business has evolved, obviously, over the years. ETF.com started its index universe back in 2007. I joined shortly thereafter, and really was built on ETF education and data. That was sort of the big idea. And over the years, it's had data businesses, which spun out, and events businesses, which spun out. And what we are now is in some ways smaller, because we're not running 12 other businesses, but it is also more focused. And so we're really just focused on producing the content that really helps investors and advisors make better decisions. We're spending a lot of energy on sort of pop-up event stuff. So you'll see the ETF Beach House showing up at Future Proof and other events over the coming year or two, producing a lot of, you know, hopefully a lot of really interesting conversations with folks who are down in the weeds in this business doing the really interesting stuff, like you guys yourself.
Well, I was guessing that, you know, you either came back or they asked you to come back because I don't know. And I'm guessing it was because of your fearlessness.
I mean,
that you're not afraid to say the hard things, right? That you're not afraid to.
It was certainly part of the conversation when I came back was, you know, are they going to put me in a box? I'm very clearly, I'm not going in any boxes. By the same token, you know, I do try to make sure that I'm being fair. And when I make a mistake, I try to call it really quickly. I posted something on Twitter yesterday that was completely erroneous. I tried to own it as fast as I could and take it down. I think that's really important and incredibly rare right now. You don't see a lot of people owning up to their mistakes or when they go too far in an argument. And I think that's really important. But also a big part of it, honestly, as I had thought about just stepping out and retiring, is I care about this industry, which sounds stupid because it's a freaking market structure, right? Like, I don't care about ETFs. It's a piece of legal documentation. But the people in this industry have done more good for the average human being on the planet than most other industries I know. And that sounds dumb, but the reality is the ETF industry has been this force for clarity, transparency, intelligence in investing, honesty, efficiency. Like, it's pretty easy to get behind those as a credo. And so I kind of want to defend that. I don't want this industry to just become extracted. I want it to continue to help my kids build portfolios and lives.
Yeah. And it's not about cheerleading the ETF industry.
It's going to be.
No. You cheerlead, but seriously, you cheerlead the progress, you cheerlead the positives. But what I sincerely love about you is just that you're not afraid to call out the bad stuff, the things that you don't like, you're seeing the developments that are, you know, taking the market in another direction or taking investors in another direction or, you know, leading you know, investors. And I think to Mike's point, which was that, you know, just because we've settled on the idea that ETFs are a wonderful wrapper, and efficient and low costing in general, doesn't mean they're all great. Doesn't mean they're all good. Doesn't mean they're all going to be useful. And then they're not all things to all people.
And it doesn't mean that the ETF is the be all end all either. Like, as Mike was saying, there's some extraordinarily good reasons to be in a mutual fund, right? And there's
absolutely
good reasons for people to buy annuities and life insurance. And like, I mean, most financial products have a very good reason for existing. They generally were created to solve some sort of problem. And so the challenge is just, as we continue to innovate, how do we make sure that we're using, you know, the right wrapper for the right problem? I don't think it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah. And what you do by keeping the industry honest is you cause further innovation in the right direction, right? So products get launched, there's a thought process around them, and then there's ways to improve that product. And we've seen that across the board as products have been launched. There's, you know, sort of version one, version 2.0, version 2.3, version 4, and they improve, but they improve because they get candid feedback and they get honest feedback that allows for that development and allows for investor education to push it in the right direction. And that by far is where most of the assets, if we were to look at an asset weighted version of where the assets are, they're mostly in the best sort of stuff by a long shot.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
So really we're talking about around the fringe, around some of the new developments of products, which is normal. That's normal to have an innovation that then subsequently gets improved upon as others launch products to make those improvements to better serve investors. And that comes with someone like yourself and someone like ETF.com to do that sort of work.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I will say the best example that of what you just talked about, Mike, is the very first ETF in the US, which was SPY, which is now being eclipsed by VOO. Which is, I hate to say it, a better product. It's not a UIT. It's a little bit cheaper. It tracks a little bit better. It manages its cash a little better. At the margins, nobody should care about. We're talking basis points here. But the reality is, you know, people like SPY was the very first one, and it has been improved upon. And there will be a new king in that category. And that is, that actually makes me hopeful, right? When you can take something as dominant as SPY, and the actual efficiency, no matter how small it is, of another product can beat it over, granted, 20 years, that still gives me hope. Like, the best stuff should win.
That was the first ETF in the U.S.
Yeah, but not the first ETF. That was yours. I said U.S. I said U.S.
Oh, yeah. You did. Oh, Canada.
Yeah, you did. Okay.
Oh, Canada.
Yes, and that. So we're up on an hour, but I do want people to understand where all the places they can reach you, Dave. So give us the list.
So ETF.com is my home, and you'll see myself and Sumeet Roy primarily cranking out content there, covering the market day to day. I tend to write less frequently and do a lot more video. So I do an every other week podcast called the ETF Zoo, which is just ETF pundits arguing about all the stuff we've been arguing about here. No issuers invited. I'm on Excess Returns once a month doing a show with Matt Ziegler and Cam Dawson. You can find me there as well. And if you want to read the stuff that's not about the markets, that's at Nodig.com, mostly hot takes on new music.
Love it.
Awesome.
And all the Twitter stuff and like Dave Nodig everywhere, all the different social things.
Yeah. Well, Dave, thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is a blast.
Yeah.
Oh, I agree. Pleasure.
It's wonderful
to get into the Nodig brain.
Thank you, Dave. Hope to have you back soon.
Me too.